My name is Rod Hills. I'm the non-executive chairman of the governance program here. Jerry Hyman, who runs the program, went up to see if the recorder works. And Nat Aaron, our deputy director, is over here. We welcome all of you. This is a nice day for us. It marks in one way the 10th anniversary of the founding of our program 10 years ago in September. And we're delighted in particular that everybody here, all the panelists, are founding members of our advisory board or our academic council. And we have Bill Webster and Carla Hills, who are also members of our founding board. So we're awful glad you're all here. To hear Frederick talk about anti-corruption failures and successful reforms, a fresh assessment. If you read his biographical sketch, you can see that nobody's better qualified to speak about it. And if you read the biographical sketches of everybody else, you'll see that nobody's better qualified to comment on it. So we're pleased that you can all be with us. I'm not going to try to add to the biographical sketches, other than to say that Professor Johnson has written another book, which is important to us. It is Political and Social Foundations for Reform, Anti-Corruption Strategies for the Philippines. Michael wrote that in conjunction with our Center for Governance at the Asian Institute of Management of the Philippines. It's been a Bible for us over there, and it's been followed and respected by the government of the Philippines. It's a program that we hope to expand to Indonesia, Mexico, and Kenya, where we have other centers. Our program today will be Frederick speaking for about 20 minutes. Each of the panelists will talk for about 5 minutes. We'll ask you for your questions, and then we'll come back to the panel. Frederick.
Thank you so very much. It's really a double pleasure to be here, associated with the 10th anniversary of the program, and then to be able to inaugurate this hall in the new facilities, very impressive facilities of CSIS. What I want to talk about, so I'm going to divide my presentation into two parts. The first is about understanding why anti-corruption has been failing so often. And I'm going to put forward three hypotheses. And then I'm going to make some suggestions about what some alternatives could be. And I'm focusing especially on developing emerging countries, although some of the implications could perhaps go beyond that. Now, in order to strengthen my point, I of course have to make the case that things are indeed failing and not going altogether that well. Even though anti-corruption has been on the international development agenda now for a solid 20 years, the progress that has been made in many countries is actually far short of expectations. Were the expectations too high? That's a question that can be raised. But the fact is that both domestic constituencies and international ones did invest a great deal of effort, political capital, financial resources, human resources into this, and the feedback hasn't been altogether that positive. You see that in evaluations of World Bank programming, of DFID, of international organizations working in this field, and then you take the simple metric of conviction rates of senior figures, political figures, not just of the opposition, but people in power, and it really hardly is taking hold. Are governments, are people more confident in the state of governance in most of these countries? The fact is, not largely, no. There are a handful of exceptions, but they really are only a handful. Now, we could do one thing. We could look at that handful and see what lessons can we extract from those. But I want to look at the bigger picture here. And as I said, I have three hypotheses for why things aren't working that well. So the first one, I'll get the most controversial one out of the way first. At the aggregate level, corruption is definitely a bad thing. And studies that have been done, and the boom in econometric, in macroanalytic research over the last 15 years supports that, and I won't go through that. Also, at a basic human emotional level, people feel the pain, they feel the frustration, they see the abuse of power. And it's been what fueled revolution, social movements in country after the country. And yet decisions are not taken at the aggregate level, usually. They might be taken by policymakers, but firms, individuals, don't take most of their decisions at the aggregate level. They do things that are sensible for them. And if you look at the weight of the anti-corruption literature, because that's really what it is, it bolsters and strengthens the case for why corruption is a bad thing and something needs to be done about it. there's a discrepancy between ongoing practices and this literature, right? People nonetheless are engaging in it. So why are they engaging in it when the literature tells us that it's such an aberrant and such a bad thing? There must be something in it for them. Now, looking through, and this is where you have to take almost an ethnographic lens, you have to talk to people, you have to meet with people to understand why do they engage in these practices, to understand that a little bit better. Now, I have a little over 20 propositions of why that happens. I don't have the time to go into them, but I want to give you just a few examples beyond the very obvious ones, that corruption is a means to accumulate power, means to accumulate wealth, and a means to retain power and wealth, and some of the fastest means of attaining both in many countries. That's the obvious statement. But there are a few others on top of that. So from the point of view of the poor, it's a means to social mobility. And that's a controversial point and an uncomfortable one. But Ashish Nandi, one of the big public intellectuals in India, has put forward a hypothesis that in India there are only five paths to social mobility. They are Bollywood, sports, criminality, politics, and corruption. Those are the five paths to social mobility. Now notice that hard work and education or starting a business are not among the five, right? I repeat, Bollywood, cricket usually, right? Politics, criminality, or corruption. And all of these are pretty colorblind in a sense that you can be from any caste religion and you can make progress if you're handsome in Bollywood, if you're good at sports in cricket, if you're not inclined to risk your life, so criminality isn't a good avenue. So that then leaves you with politics and corruption. And he says, until we change that equation in India, we're going to have a lot of corruption coming from below, let alone the fact that those in power, of course, try to retain it. So corruption has a path to social mobility in countries where there aren't that many other avenues for doing so. Then you have corruption as a way, of course, of protecting impunity in a judicial system that doesn't work. But think of it the other way, as a way of protecting weak, vulnerable people against utterly unjust laws. Examples of this abound, but you know, one of the most egregious one is in Afghanistan, where the family code dictates that a woman who leaves her husband, who is beating her, raping her, is breaching the law and can be jailed for that. Right? It's not allowed to leave your husband, even though he is committing acts of violence. And the only women who are jailed for this are the women who weren't able to pay their way out. Obviously, the law is utterly egregious, and bribing your way out of such a jail is the only sensible thing to do. And yet, many women don't have the means to do so. So, of course, bribing under those circumstances is the only sensible thing to do. If we go through those 21 propositions that I have of the functions of corruption in different settings, they work for different people in different ways. And unfortunately, it is the only avenue for people in different settings. And anti-corruption, and this is the point, hasn't provided very good viable alternatives in most cases to that. Now, less controversial proposition. The second one is that we haven't understood how spoilers spoil the game of anti-corruption. So what you can read a literature that's evolved over the last years about how we've made mistakes in the way programs have been designed. And if they were more responsive to local circumstances, and if they involved people more, if there were more consultations, then surely things would work better. If they were more adapted to local priorities and circumstances. But what I have come across over the last 20 years of working in this area is how donors and other players have been hoodwinked time and again. And most, you know, awfully of all, is actually domestic constituencies who've hoped and wanted and voted for reform and then have been disappointed time and again. And I would put that in the category of the spoilers and recognizing how spoilers spoil the game and how easy it is for them often to be able to do so. And I've identified seven main methods that they use for doing so. And they use, not in order, but muscle power, legal judicial power, money power, simply withdrawing budgets, not paying for it, administrative political power, disinformation, social power, and technology. And the simplest one of them all is, of course, administrative political power, and is simply to say yes. That's the most powerful way of undermining a reform, is when the newly elected prime minister says, I want a plan, 100 days, 3 months, 2 years, for these reforms, the senior bureaucrats say yes. Now sit down, we're going to do it. We're even going to call on the World Bank, USAID and others, to help us design it. They will pay for it. All the things are set up. The laws are passed eventually. The commission is established, but nothing really happens, right? In the meantime, other things move on. That kind of practice is not unique to developing countries. Right? When Al Gore brought together people to think about reinventing government, senior people, one of them told me, they said, yes, of course we're going to do that. And very little happened as a result. This is not unique. But what is awkward is that the literature on spoilage almost doesn't exist. So if you look at log frames, for example, of projects, yes, they might identify some of these as risks. But understanding how bureaucrats at various levels are able to spoil the game, what methods they use, how astute they are, and that this falls well beyond the realm of the way most projects are designed, the literature on that almost doesn't exist at all. It exists when it comes to business transformation, but it doesn't exist when it comes to public sector reform in any serious way. So people know it intuitively. Some people who've been working in the business for a long time can tell you stories about it. But it hasn't really been written up. It's difficult to research. And then the third reason why things aren't working all that well. And the third reason has to do with measurements, in my view. And so I've been involved in measuring corruption for a long time. I was the head of research of Transparency International for 10 years. And so everyone knows the Corruption Perceptions Index. The Corruption Perceptions Index is the most famous of the measurement tools in this area, but the World Bank and others have developed other sets of tools. These have been great tools at the aggregate level. They were fantastic in terms of raising awareness and putting the issue on the agenda. And these have been miserable tools in terms of understanding how policy is being implemented on the ground, whether there's real traction, whether something real is happening. And while there are some indicators out there that have tried to be more specific, institution by institution, they're either too expensive, too complex, to be done really over time and comparatively. The most powerful indicator that I think has developed a positive indicator of change, because these have largely been also, they have two features. One is that they're focused on the negative, but they're also predicated on a certain assumption, which is that what we do is to try to measure the scale of the problem, to know what's the scope of corruption, what's the scope of criminality, and then to try to, of course, check 2 years, 5 years later, whether that's been reduced. But there is a flaw in that. First, as I said, those measurements actually haven't been particularly comparative over time. They're not drilling down into the details. So, for example, when you see that on the Corruption Perceptions Index, countries that share the same score include countries as diverse as Liberia, Bulgaria, and China. What does that really tell you, right? When these three countries share exactly the same score, do they have the same scale, total volume of corruption? Of course not. Is it because people pay the same amounts of bribe, experience it equally often? We actually don't know. We have no way of knowing, but these three countries share the same score. The other is that these are negative formulations, of course. So they're a stick, they're not a carrot. Right? The most effective alternative to this that everyone is also familiar with is the ease of doing business report. A positive formulation and something really tangible. How many days does it take me to set up a business? How many days does it take me to get a phone license, to get a construction permit, etc.? It's something tangible, something real, but it's also a positive formulation. Now, because the literature and the practice hasn't really, in my view, addressed the measurement problem, the spoilers, understood how they function and how they undermine the game, and hasn't been dealing with the basic needs that are still fulfilled by some of these corrupt transactions, we, again, have a losing game. Now I want to turn this around and see what might be some of the ways forward and why there is actually a prospect for doing these things slightly differently. So what we have tried over the last 5 years is something we call community integrity building. The NGO I head was created 10 years ago. It's called Integrity Action. And what we have tried to do was to find that way of working on very specific problems and making it possible for people to make an impact on things that matter to them. So that's the first premise, is asking people, what are the services, what are the goods, what are the infrastructures that really matter to people? because that's where they're going to be willing to devote some effort. Also, to do this purely on the basis of voluntarism, in order to make sure that people are really doing this because they care about it. So addressing the issue of priorities, of their basic concerns and needs. But then there was this measurement challenge, right? And the measurement that we propose as a way forward is something we call the fix rate. Now, what's the fix rate? The fix rate is a single fix. Let me describe that first. A single fix is the resolution of a problem to the satisfaction of the main stakeholders and using the tools of transparency, accountability, anti-corruption, right? So the resolution of one problem using these tools and to the satisfaction of the main stakeholders. The rate at which that happens, so if we try it 10 times, we discover 10 problems, we resolve 5 of them, then we have a fixed rate, 50%. So a bit like the ease of doing business, we're measuring something positive and we're measuring something concrete because it's a specific problem that people have. Rather than trying to get bogged down in understanding what is the exact scale of the problem, which I've told you is actually very, very difficult to do and extremely costly, it's measuring something tangible and precise. Now, what we've been doing over the last 5 years is refining that methodology, testing things which in the end turned out not to work and other things that work quite well, and achieving for infrastructure a fix rate of on average between 60 to 80%. So of the problems that people identified, they were able to resolve 60 to 80% of them. For public services, it's half that. But when we've gone back to the data, it's now edging up to 60%. So it's tougher to resolve public services, but still, they're able to do that. Now, what are some concrete examples? So I'll give you two quickly. One is very straightforward in a sense, is in Afghanistan, people we were working with were looking at a road and they were able to get access to the contract. And what they found out was this road was contracted to be built 8 meters wide, but it was actually built 5 meters wide. It was contracted for 5 centimeters and it was built 1 to 2 centimeters thick. So the fix is being able to get it back to 8 meters and 5 centimeters thickness, but without spending a dollar on gravel, asphalt, or anything else. And this is what in community after community they've been able to achieve. A community in Kenya that didn't have running water for 20 years and that has had water pump after water pump installed by various government agencies, still no water, now has running water for the first time. And we didn't pay a dollar for piping or a pump. Another example on a service is in Kyrgyzstan, where the thing that most frustrated the residents of this city, Narin, was garbage. The city was filthy, and actually there's a US twist to it because aid had funded a garbage treatment facility. So they had the hardware, which is partly why they were so frustrated. There was a beautiful site, but the garbage wasn't being collected. And through this process, which I'll describe in a little more detail, a resolution was found to the extent that people were willing to pay their municipal taxes. And the municipal rate collection went up over tenfold because now they had garbage being collected. Now, the ingredients of this community integrity building include then three elements which are, I would call, slightly counterintuitive to anti-corruption work as it's been developing around the world. The few elements that are maybe less counterintuitive, I would say, in a sense, and there are many efforts similar to that, one is working with volunteers, working widely, is working on a consultative basis, collaborative basis. But the counterintuitive elements are the following. The first is that we've been able to do this even in situations where the principal, I would call it, like the mayor, the governor, is not on board. It helps to have these people on board by far, but we're able to achieve a high fix rate even in situations where the principal isn't on board. And that's a bit unique to this method. There are other cases, other methods that rely heavily, of course, on having that principle on board. The second counterintuitive element is that we work collaboratively, constructively, because the only way to achieve high fixed rates is to work collaboratively with the public sector. But the counterintuitive element is that even in the most corrupt setting, take Afghanistan, you can find people to work with in the public sector, but they might not be senior. They might be actually quite junior. They might be you know, second, third from the bottom tier. But finding those and finding the means of engaging them, that's the key. And then the third element is that hard evidence of corruption matters a great deal. That if we can find smoking guns, hard evidence or circumstantial evidence of corruption, it provides incredible leverage. So clearly, in this case of the road, you can just put, you know, do the sums and you can see how much money was stolen. So there was more than enough circumstantial evidence there. But instead of using that to gain publicity, to make a scandal, it's to be entirely focused on getting a resolution, on getting a fix. Now we know, of course, there are weaknesses involved in that. You could say this is not the legal way of doing things, right? But the legal system in many of these countries doesn't work at all. But perhaps, and the other element you could say is this person says, fine, I'm going to pay the money back this time. I'm going to fix that road. I'll steal somewhere else. Inevitably, that's going to happen. And yet it's built a certain confidence in people that it's possible to make change happen, right? Had they gone to court, it would never have been resolved. Had they simply made a stink of it in the media, a journalist would likely have gotten killed. And I'm proud to say that of all the monitoring we have done involving projects worth millions and millions, several hundred million, no one has gotten killed. And that's because the focus has been entirely on the resolution. Now, what follows from this is if the fix rate is a useful way of understanding whether transparency, accountability, anti-corruption tools, whatever you call them, are able to contribute, as I said, without spending money on gravel, without spending money on tubes, on water pumps, actually to make water flow, to make schools function better. That begs the question how you could apply the fix rate to other sets of questions involving this. So, for example, looking at two access to information laws. Access to information laws have been passed in over 100 countries over the last decade. It's been a revolution in that area. And yet, to what extent are these laws really being used? Who uses them? How easy are they to use? Let me contrast two pieces of legislation. In India, if I submit an access to information request to you, an Indian public official, if you don't respond within 21 days, 300 rupees is taken off your salary every day, about $10, right? Every day. You're a Kenyan public official. Kenya passed an access to information law in the wake of their new constitution. If you don't respond within a month, I have a right to sue you, right? So both of them have leverage attached to them, right? They both have delays attached to them. But if I'm a poor person writing to you, and you know that I'm poor because the thing I'm asking about is a poor person's need, which one is going to produce a higher fix rate? The Indian law or the Kenyan law? Right? The Indian law by far. And so if we measure then, if we start looking at fix rates, not just in the aggregate, but actually disaggregated for poor people, for ethnic minorities, for gender, for the kinds of issues that are being addressed, we would get a far better sense of whether these tools, of these norms, are really working and who they're working for. I'll end on that. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you well. Professor Johnson has written a great book, The Syndromes of Corruption. He's been a great mentor to us. He and Ron Goldstock came down to help us organize the office in the University of Indonesia. And we're glad to hear from you, Michael.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Rod. I'm very much on board with a great deal of what Frederick has said here. I've got a project of my own that begins with the notion that not much has worked out well for reform over the past generation and explores some similar ideas. And I mean, it seems to me that his first hypothesis is really quite an important one that we overlook, and that is that many people who may suffer from corruption in the long run may think they have a short-term stake in it, or may even just hope they have a short-term stake in it. And even if that isn't quite true, reform as an enterprise is risky, it's uncertain, it involves a lot of costs. And the like. Reform is not always a credible kind of slogan. People have heard it all before. And we make that worse at times by creating collective action problems, by going into corrupt places and saying, let's clean up corruption because it will be good for everyone. Well, Yes, it probably will, but that's like saying, let's clean up the air. That's very difficult and expensive to do, and if you succeed at it, I will benefit, so I'm going to sit back and wait for you to do the heavy lifting, and as a result, things don't get done. So that sort of collective action problem has been a historical problem. The best way around it, I think, is to redescribe reform in terms of people's everyday concrete quality of life needs. And for that, I think we are very much on the same wavelength. His third hypothesis, that of measurement, is critical as well. And in that sense, we have an opportunity with better measures of corruption to send out important kinds of signals. If a given town or jurisdiction can show that they had been paying 50% too much for fuel and now they're paying 20% and then 10% and so forth, they're sending signals to people that there's not as much money to be made in corruption in this place. Maybe they'd best go elsewhere. There's a chance to squeeze out the scope of corruption, and all of that can energize anti-corruption forces that are out there. The fixed rate concept has a great deal of potential, both for community mobilization, community integrity building on the one hand, and measurement on the other. I want to suggest that to some extent there are probably trade-offs between those two goals, that especially if the goal is to come up with a measurement that is comparable across jurisdictions or even just over time, the need to specify and standardize methodology and standards may come at the expense of being able to connect with what people in the here and now believe are their needs in a given community. So those trade-offs are, I think, something that have to be kept in mind. If the data are to be published, I think that's a fine thing, and as I suggested, that's a way of sending some useful and powerful messages. At the same time, data can be gamed, they can be misused. Over the long term, there may be an ownership problem with the fixed rate scheme, where a politician moves in and, in effect, by political muscle or other incentives, buys it off, takes it over, and suddenly the data don't mean as much as perhaps we hoped that they would. In divided or post-conflict societies, I think the issue of the fixed rate probably should be implemented across a very few government sectors and as broadly as possible, rather than to tap into the possibly zero-sum competition of various parts of the constituency. On the plus side, though, I think we have a very powerful tool here potentially for trust building, for building credibility in government, a tool for encouraging people and rewarding them for doing so, to engage with officials on their daily problems rather than with fixers and the like. Many reforming countries, and here I'm thinking of Ghana in particular, have found it a real struggle to get people to bring their problems to officials and into the political arena. We take that for granted. In highly corrupt places, people don't. Ghana is winning that battle, and I think in part in ways that may have something in common with the fixed rate scheme. I think the fact that the fixed rate is linked to concrete quality of life problems is a tremendous advantage. It's a way around those collective action issues as well, and for that the issue deserves considerable praise. Longer term issues possibly too, sustainability. Will it be possible to keep activism going at the level that it needs to go? It may build on the basis of the data for a time. I suppose the possibility that the scheme would succeed so much that it puts itself out of business might be a nice problem to have, but there are many examples on the ground in a variety of countries of good schemes that get off the ground, and whether fatigue sets in or whatever, they become hard to sustain. I'm sure Frederick has given thought to all of these caveats. So I think we have a variety of great propositions about what the reform movement needs to change about its way of doing business. A good idea for both mobilization and measurement, one that may involve some internal trade-offs that have to be given considerable thought, but on the whole, a very encouraging message in a variety of ways.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Nancy Boswell is Transparency International as far as we're concerned in this country. And pleased that she is now head of international program on anti-corruption at the American University School of Law. Nancy.
Thank you, Rod, and compliments to you and all you've done with the Hills Governance Centers. I think this is such an enormous problem that all of us need to continue the efforts that we have underway. We talk about how many people now are working on anti-corruption, that it seems like a crowded space. But I think when we think about the extent of the problem, it's probably a good thing that we're all in it together. I have some written comments that I started to jot down when I read Frederick's publication on fixed rate, and I commend it to all of you. It's very thought-provoking. It's very innovative. But in some of the things he said made other things come to mind, so I'll try to put some points together. Let me start by saying Frederick and I met in 1994, I believe, when Transparency International was just founded. So in some ways it seems like a very long time ago, but I think actually in terms of what we were up against in those early days, it's actually early days. 1994, the U.S. was the only country with a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Nobody else outlawed paying bribes to do business abroad. The World Bank, Jim Wolfensohn, the president, said he couldn't use the C word within the confines of the bank. When I would talk to public officials from various countries, they would get terribly defensive, say, this is our sovereign right, and you shouldn't be interfering. And business said, how else do we do business? So I think when we think about are we failing or succeeding, I would take a longer view. We think about environmental reform, climate change, all of these issues. It takes a while. And in the first instance, we simply had to get people to talk about the issue, let alone do something about it. So not to in any way minimize, I think, the very strong points that you make, but I do think that we are moving. Second of all, I think we have not put the resources behind this that are required. Yes, it's probably a lot of money in a hole, but when you think about the number of government officials, the number of companies doing transactions in countries around the world, and you think about the amount of money and political will that has been put into what needs to get done, I think we haven't done that to the extent we should either. So these issues of resources, understanding what's going on, I think are important to keep in mind. The second thing is Frederick is talking at the micro level, which I think is where we need to look. That's where corruption hurts. That's where the poorest are affected. So I think it's the work he's doing is important. But I don't think we should take away from the macro reforms that are going on. Today we have conventions on bribery and corruption from the OECD prohibiting paying the bribes to regional conventions, UN convention, that address not only paying bribes but demanding them, that go beyond bribery to the integrity of how public institutions work. Access to information that was mentioned, whistleblower protection, all of the elements of what we need to fight corruption are in there, and 160 countries and counting have ratified them, these agreements. So we have the basic structure. And I would be remiss with Ambassador Hills here not to mention our trade agreements, many, many trade agreements that have been concluded have anti-corruption transparency, procurement transparency provisions. So in a way, we've taken on this timeline, we've legitimized the discussion, then we've moved to enacting or concluding these various legal agreements, and we are now in that phase of making sure that they are actually implemented in practice. So I would go back to sort of Frederick's approach of we need top-down and bottom-up going at the same time with the concomitant resources that are needed to get those two pieces to work the way they should. And there are peer reviews of enforcement that are hard-hitting. If you want to look at some of the country reports on how countries like France and Japan and Russia and others are doing not actually enforcing, they're on the OECD website and other websites, and you can see what is not happening, and I think that's very helpful in terms of moving the macro forward while others are working on the micro. At the country level, the micro level, Frederick talks about community integrity building, which I of course, as TI would very much support. I think it's fundamental to anti-corruption reform. Jeremy Pope, one of the founders of Transparency International, also, I believe, founder of Integrity Action, an absolutely fabulous and insightful individual, fostered this notion starting in 93 with the beginning of TI that you had to bring the community together. You needed the public officials, you needed the private sector, you had to have civil society together, understanding the local context, identifying the challenges, and working together to develop recommendations and ensure that they were actually put into practice. So I think the community integrity building approach is fundamental, and I think we're beginning to see it replicated or people buying into the idea in other initiatives, the extractive industry initiative, open government partnership, and so forth, but probably not to the extent necessary. And I think there's a good reason, and that is capacity. Government officials, we beat them over the head and say, you really need to talk to your own citizens. And the reaction is, well, we talk to our citizens, but they don't know what they're talking about. Or the World Bank or some of the other donors, and they'll say, they don't have the capacity. Well, of course, don't have capacity. If somebody gave me the balance sheet for the extractive for some major oil company and said, are they paying the right commissions and royalty payments, I wouldn't really know where to begin. So I think capacity building for civil society on the same, to the same extent as we have done it with public officials is essential. I think Frederick in his report talks about training trainers and doing all that we can to make sure that citizens can actually perform their function. Two, they don't have necessarily the space. Frederick talked about access to information. They have a law on the books, but can you actually use it? By the same token, you have even if you had the information, you need the technical capacity to read it and understand it. And then you need a government to whom you can bring your views and a government that will respond to that. That's not where we are in this world, regrettably. And in fact, in many situations, we even need physical protection for those who would bring their views to the government. So I think we have a long way to go, and particularly in terms of protecting those who do get involved. On citizen monitoring, which again, Frederick has used to great effect, this is a trend, I think, that has really taken off. TIUSA recently completed an online training tool for citizens to use in monitoring public purchasing, government contracting, the big ticket infrastructure items where so much money goes awry. And we developed it working with other NGOs in other countries who were already working on citizen monitoring projects, so Roadwatch in the Philippines and others who do a really good job and who shared with us some of the frustrations, some of what Frederick points out that in his discussion of sort of open loop or closed loop, did you get something resolved? What NGOs find is I monitored, I found the road wasn't wide enough, deep enough, good enough quality, but nobody paid any attention when I complained. So I do think that's a good approach, but we have more to do to make it work. In terms of measuring impact, I must say I had a little bit of problem with the fixed rate approach from only one perspective, and that is, as I understood it, it was, do citizens get the project that they wanted? Do they get the services they thought they were promised? Did the bridge get built? To me, that's not the whole answer, because if the bridge got built to nowhere, because the decision to build it was based on bribes, that wasn't the right outcome. And if the bridge fell down or decayed because the inspector was bribed to look away, then we didn't succeed. And I think underlying all of this is this corrosion of public trust. Just because I got a bridge doesn't mean I trust my government any more today than I did yesterday. So I would say that I think it's a great tool. I think we need all the tools we can get. It's a good one, but I don't think we should lose sight of the corruption corrosion factor and the fact that we need to address it. So kudos on the innovation and the deep thinking. I really think it's a great panel, great opportunity to talk about some of these issues.
from the waterfronts of Manhattan to the Northern Island. Time off for the Brotherhood of Teamsters. Ron Goldstock has had more criminal activity than almost anybody could ever meet. Ron?
More criminal.
Yes. Thank you. I think. I normally am on a panel to look at what somebody says and try to poke as many holes in it as possible. And I am in a position of really joining the Frederick fan club on this one, because I think that he has done an extraordinarily good job in analyzing particular types of corruption. I say it for different reasons than you talked about, but I think it's important when we think in terms of corruption, we normally think of it as a monolith, like how do we deal with corruption? But that's like asking the question, how do we deal with disease? And you're not going to deal with disease the same way, because penicillin works for one problem doesn't mean it's going to work for another one. And so we tend to have these formulae and, you know, sort of general statements about corrupt activity, which I don't think work very well. On the other hand, when you're talking about particular problems that affect particular individuals, then it becomes a problem-solving technique. Mm. And you can deal with the situations that make those issues corrupt or non-working and how to resolve them. And I think that's extraordinarily important. And I think the fix is important for reasons other than you suggested. Part is that it's very helpful to the people that are there. Two is, as Michael said, what it does is say to a company that is corrupt, I can't make the kind of money that I expected to in this project. I'm going to go somewhere else on the next one. But I think the third thing is once the corrupt company leaves and getting and having gotten the job because they underbid honest companies, figuring that they could do the road 5 meters wide rather than 8, it means that honest companies can come in, put in real bids, and fight over each other based on, in some degree price, but also the value of their construction. And that solves the problem of the bridge falling down, and because they take pride in their work, and when they're chosen because of what they can do, and you look at what they have done in the past, I think it makes a huge difference. I have spent most of my professional life doing prosecution, and have done prosecution in the area of corrupt activities. But I think that Frederick's approach is a lot better than mine. I may be enforcing the rule of law, but rarely do I get any results other than putting a bad person in prison. I don't cure corruption problems by prosecuting corrupt public officials. And history shows you that. Not only is it sometimes not work at all, sometimes it's counterproductive. Judge Webster knows this better than anybody. In the 1950s, you had a corrupt public official as head of the Teamsters Union. He's indicted, convicted, goes to prison, Jimmy Hoffa comes in, and Jimmy Hoffa brings in the mob. Now the union is totally corrupt. Hoffa is indicted, convicted, goes to prison, Frank Fitzsimmons comes in, and the mob gains a stronger hold on the union. Fitzsimmons is investigated. He dies while in office, sort of the functional equivalent of capital punishment. And Roy Williams comes in, the problem doesn't get any better. Jackie Presser comes in, the problem doesn't get any better. And ultimately, it is that a monitorship over the union creates the cultural change within the union that allows it to succeed. It is an extraordinary example of how prosecution, punishment is counterproductive. Now, it's not always counterproductive, but in many, many ways, it doesn't turn the tide. And something like this does, because you're able to deal with the particular problems and handle them. So what you need is really systemic reform, and the systemic reform on the local level will come from citizen monitoring that can look at the problems, but that clearly isn't enough. And the reason it's not enough, and Frederick will tell you this, is that there are limitations. These are not technicians. They can look and measure the width of a road and the depth of a road, but they can't do analysis of what the road bed is made of. They can't determine whether or not the number of rivets is the right amount. They can't count the number of trucks that leave and determine how full the trucks are to determine whether or not there is corrupt behavior in terms of billings. And so they have an important role to play, but I think not the only role. I think the reverse monitoring becomes important as well. That is to say that the companies engaged in the work have to have their own monitor made up of more sophisticated individuals who very carefully look at what is being done and how it's being done, have the scientific ability to test products as they're being used, have investigative capability, forensic accounting capability, analytic and research capability, which is not volunteer and reasonably expensive. But if Frederick's right, and the cost of waste, abuse, and fraud on a typical project is 20-25%, he would say, at least. If you put in 2% in terms of monitoring, and the monitors were only able to catch half the fraud, you would still be ahead 500%. So I think both have to be done, but it is a really innovative approach, and one that I think works very well.
A little history. The campaign against corruption began no earlier than 1975 when the SEC accidentally found that American Airlines had bribed a foreign official in South America out of a secret bank account. Some of the staff at SEC set up, kind of interested, let's look at other bank accounts. Found several others, and so the SEC required a couple of things. First of all, they required auditors to say, if you see something suspicious, you can't just say, you can't clear with the company, you've got to bring it to somebody independent. The New York Stock Exchange was caused to create independent audit committees. And 407 companies, more than that, but well over 400 companies, confessed that they bribed foreign officials. That was long before the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed. The transparency created by effective auditing has as much to do with it as prosecution. I mention that simply to think back on what progress, as Nancy said. When we first started telling people that companies had bribed people, Prime Minister of Japan took $21 million from Lockheed to sell some airplanes. The SEC was pilloried, criticized, none of your damn business. What are you trying to do, sink the American business ship? And it was really a couple years before politicians found a good issue and changed the tide. So it's been only 35, 40 years since we've had an interest in the world. We have made some progress, and thanks to people like Frederick, we can make some more. Now, questions, please. Please just yell your name out and ask the question.
My name is Miguel Schloss. I'm from the other end of the world. I'm from Chile. I haven't come to these conferences for quite a while, and I'm very happy to hear Fred with a more self-critical view of what is happening and whether we are moving the needle or not. 5-10 years ago when I came, these types of meetings were all self-congratulatory, and the evidence was at best anecdotal and very, very partial. And I think we need a critical view, and only that will help us to move the needle and move forward. My question is, could it be, and I don't know whether this is a fourth hypothesis or it fits within one of your three, that the approach has to dealing with corruption has put an undue emphasis on controls, on compliance, on enforcement, on new laws, lots of formalities, all very labor intensive, and in many places institutionally intensive, institutionally weak countries. And therefore they are faced with an inherent contradiction as to how much really can be done. Could it be, conversely, that the answer, at least part of it, I'm not saying that this is it, that the solutions in many places have to be in really reducing drastically, systemically, using your words, the discretionary powers of those who have monopoly of powers, governments, for instance, and institutions of that sort, empowering people not only by asking them, but by passing resources to them so that they vote with their pocketbooks as to where they send their children to school and so on. We've done that in Chile, and it has been, on the whole, tough, but it has helped discipline a bit the checks and balances, in other words, so that there are controls of the society, of the authorities, local and national, and there is a bit more of an organic solution, not so complicated as these EITIs and so on.
Any comments?
Do you understand the question?
My view, Miguel, is that certainly there's far too much emphasis on compliance. And you can divide, in my view, compliance between proactive and reactive compliance. And the reactive compliance is, I find out you've done something, and of course I have to punish you. And so that the key metric for that is simply conviction rates. And conviction rates have not been stellar. Then there is proactive compliance, in a sense. And that's where there's been a lot of creative work happening. But if you dig down and you try to find out what's really happened as a result of it, I'm afraid to give one example, is integrity pacts. And you dig down and you find out what's happened as a result of these, actually very little. There's not the strong evidence to show that they do. And there's one indicator that would tell you that something is really going on. Because if we know that the cost overruns generally are of some order of magnitude, you should see cost savings as a result of these. And there's no evidence of cost savings over time. One time, yes, but not over time. So what we argue for is a more proactive integrity approach, different from compliance, and where it's really about building systems. I diverge from you just a little bit, though, on the discretion issue. Right, the best teachers in the world, by various measurements, are Finnish teachers. And Finnish teachers are given a huge amount of discretion. If you look at the best doctors, if you look at best managers, the best managers often have a fair degree of discretion. They don't have someone looking over their shoulder on every decision that they make. They don't have to report on absolutely everything they do. So we also have to trust people, and that brings us back to a comment Ron made, is how do we build trust? Because if we're only looking and auditing, overseeing, controlling, and creating more and more transparency and oversight, it doesn't build trust. In fact, we find out that it reduces trust. So yes, people having choice is a different issue, right? But opening the doors of oversight to everything is not the answer either.
Any comments?
I think there's an interesting and a very accurate argument here that we probably have over-relied on controls, prohibitions, and the like without paying enough attention to how we're going to ensure that they be enforced, that they gain credibility, that they be linked to people's day-to-day problems. And in that sense, historically, if you look at societies that have seemingly had some success of dealing with corruption, they often did so not through controls but through political contention, and that is empowering people to insist that their needs be addressed and that their property be respected and so forth. And once they have that power to demand that, then the variety of controls can be put in place to address those needs and can be done in a way that you can take political credit for doing. So I would really echo at least that part of Mr. Schloss's comments.
You know, part of this is, I think, what I started off talking about. If we talk about it in generalities, like disease, you say, should we just reduce discretion? I think, and do we over-rely on rules? If you don't have rules, then obviously nothing is going to be done correctly. You could have massive amounts of corruption. On the other hand, if you put into effect building codes, for example, that have too many rules in it, people can't navigate through it, so they have to bribe their way to get around it. Or hire expediters, which then can give you a license in 2 days, which is a sign of corruption, not a lack of corruption. I mean, it's one of the real issues. So you have to really understand what is occurring in that area. If you reduce discretion so that a person must be prosecuted when they leave their husband, who's been beating them, then there'll be bribes because it's an unjust situation. So you need to have discretion where a prosecutor exercises rational thought in determining whether or not somebody should be held accountable. And so you really have to look at the specific issue rather than a broad generality, I think.
I would just build on the specific aspect of what you're saying, which is there are places where reducing discretion has absolutely worked, and that's usually where things have become computerized. So where the customs system is put online and you avoid the many different officials that you might otherwise have had to deal with, there it has been effective. Not to say that social media and IT are always effective, but that's one way it reduces discretion.
Another question, please.
I'm Bob Hershey, I'm a consultant. You cited the example of putting the customs system online. And I was thinking, are there other things you can cite of putting things on the internet and getting the transparency, perhaps in the decision-making part of the process?
I mean, I think two thoughts come to my mind. One is, you know, one I'm familiar with here, which is the U.S. system. I mean, there's an enormous amount of data online. We have federal hearings, federal registers. I mean, everything goes up online, and if you want to make a comment, if you want to go to the hearing and be heard, you can. So in that respect, I think it helps, and it's, to Frederick's point, access to information puts the burden on the citizens to demand the information. Publication of information, an affirmative obligation to publish everything so that you leave a very discrete universe of remaining information that has to be requested, to me is a far better approach. And the fact that we have the internet, we have the web, means that it's much easier today. One of the examples that I would point to is the World Bank, where the data, all their lending data, I mean, they've done just a phenomenal job of putting online. Whatever else we think of other ways they approach things, they've done a phenomenal job of putting online to whom they're lending, what they're lending, for what purpose. And that means that citizens on the other side of the world know my government committed to deliver X. And so I can then go out and monitor. And moreover, I can then go back not only to my government, but I can go back to the World Bank and say X never arrived. Mm-hmm. I sat next to the controller of the bank the other day in a meeting on social media and IT at the bank, and I said, what's the controller doing at this meeting at, you know, in IT? And he said, because I have billions of people out there who are going to report to me whether my programs are working.
Two kinds of online examples, and I'll give them very briefly. One is procurement, and several countries, Mexico is one, has been out on front. Brazil has
Chile.
Given it a good shot, Chile especially. And literally, in some cases, tracking the prices of key commodities minute by minute. And you can see if they spike up, which is one kind of worry. If they spike suspiciously low, that's another. Second, I've got a student who's going to be Prime Minister of India someday, and I hope he'll remember me fondly. And he and his cohorts gathered very quick exit interviews for people in the city of Bangalore when they left transport agencies, asking, you know, were you treated well? Was the place clean? Did you get asked for a bribe? Just a couple of questions. And are able to map out and put online which offices in the city treat people better. And people are able to avoid going to this one and instead going to that one where they have a better chance of equitable treatment.
And you can think of technology real quickly in other ways. I mean, you can have police officers wearing recorders so that the conversations are known. You could have, you don't need police officers stopping people anymore with GPS in cars. You could have, you know, automatic ticket givers. As soon as you speed, a light goes on and you receive a fine in the mail. I mean, there are all sorts of possibilities with technology that can affect corruption capability.
But if I may, so ultimately it's people who close the loop, right? It's not the technology. In the rarest cases, the technology closes the loop. It's people who make it happen. The technology can help with that. But we have to be cautious. So there is great progress, but it's also expensive. It's difficult to manage. Who owns the IP? For example, open data in Ghana is not owned by the government anymore. It's owned by a private contractor who is implementing it. Does the government have the capacity to manage this? What is the basic paper record keeping in the country? And then there's the perverse side of it. Many countries in Africa introduced very complex forms of electronic voting and electronic IDs. And in country after country, election after election, they failed at the last minute. Was it by design or was it circumstance? There's a strong suspicion that it was by design. It made it even easier to defraud the election.
Question there. Please, stand up, please.
Mm-hmm. My name is Anne-Sophie Lambert. I'm from Accountability Lab, and I wanted to ask how nonprofits and agencies involved with anti-corruption work can be open and transparent about the failures and risk involved in their work, while still not taking away from the support and the trust that they need to make successes.
Somebody want to restate the question?
Mm-hmm.
You want to know how nonprofit agencies can be dealt with?
That I'm wondering how organizations can be open about the failures. I know there's failures. You were speaking about failure on a broader scope about failures involved with corruption, but I think that that means that there will be failures in specifically the way that.
Somebody got a 30-second action? Answer?
How does an NGO admit that it failed without losing the support that you need to do the work that you're doing?
That's correct.
It's a very tough question you're asking, and thank you for asking it. I mean, I would be bold enough to say, you know, at least some of the work has to be around resolving concrete problems. And if you're putting forward an approach that you think is good for the world, let us say access to data. So access to aid data is an example. There's been a revolution in accessing aid data, not just from the World Bank, but from others. But you say that there are billions out there who are going to use it. The fact is, among poor people, the numbers who are really using it is infinitesimally small. Almost no one is using it. So it's very comfortable to be circulating this data in among aid officials and contractors and a few think tanks. But who's really using it? And that's the litmus test, right? Is it really useful for someone? And if we ask ourselves that question, unfortunately, very often, it's not.
Is that called a fix rate? Mm-hmm. Yes, in the, way in the back.
Hello, my name is Vincent Ogutu. I'm from a country that has been mentioned a few times here, from Kenya. And greetings from the Strathmore Governance Center that you helped set up throughout the field. So my question has to do with, I think, your second proposition about how in some instances there are people who are spoilers who prevent the fight against corruption from happening. And what I've observed in Kenya is that the conviction rate has been next to zero because of what I call a vicious cycle of corruption. So you have people who've been corrupt previously, let's say the previous regime, and you want to convict one of them, then he'll say, I'm not going down alone. I actually saw a judge say this on television. You know, he was caught for having received a bribe. He said, if anyone takes me to prison, I have so much information on very high level people in government. They'll all have to come with me. And then I thought he's actually daring the government. And nothing happened to him because precisely they could not put him in without ending up in prison themselves. So how do we break this vicious cycle? I mean, I have a theory that if you have an amnesty, you say, let's reset the button, come forward, declare whatever it is you've done, pay it back, and then from now on, we start monitoring. Maybe that can work. But if we just say, these are the systems, these are the punishments, let's start, it's just not going to break the vicious cycle.
Frederick's Operation Integrity Action is working with the Strathmore Center,
right,
trying to find integrity issues to go after. There's one.
There is one. Yeah. Okay. But I think the constituency, the answer partly, this is only a partial answer. The constituency has to be built from within the country. And there are so many cases exactly like the one you're describing. And so if, you know, now if it's possible to experience that change can happen, even if it doesn't mean putting bad people in jail, but it's possible to make infrastructure work better, services work better, to hold people accountable, but bring them on board, in effect. Right. So what we have seen happen in Kenya is some of the people who were involved in that have gone into politics for the very first time in their lives. They're never interested in politics. So I'm, fingers crossed a little bit. I'm hoping that something good will come of that. Of the people who've been involved in our work, several women have joined city councils. One became a vice governor. They have run for ministerial positions in county councils in Kenya. Maybe something will happen from that. But that constituency needs to be much stronger from within. And that's the only way of dealing with spoilers, ultimately. It has to be things that address people's real needs. It can't be seen as simply being politically vindictive. And there needs to be a much stronger constituency, as Michael was referring to, that's demanding this from within. But it can't be superficial. It can't be just a general statement. It has to be informed by concrete practice.
Mm-hmm.
I like the amnesty idea in principle. I mean, in a way, it means that if you decide to come clean, it's not the end of everything for you. It's a little bit like bankruptcy, and it has a similar logic to it. However, you can't try it too often, because in the Philippines, literally, they've had several rounds of amnesty, and bad guys have learned that if one amnesty isn't all that great, there may be another one coming along in a short period of time. So that has to be done very judiciously and with a wide gap between the attempts.
Yes, please.
Yeah. My name is Eric Lachica. I'm the coordinator for the Washington, D.C. chapter for the U.S. Filipinos for Good Governance. Mm-hmm. And we have this constant debate about how do we deal with a friendly government, the leadership of President Benigno Aquino III. We're critical collaborators. We want him to succeed. We support him, but we know there's a lot of temptations along the way. One of the debate issues that we are debating is that how do we play a critical role as Filipinos overseas? Like, we have almost 10 million Filipinos. We have 4 million here in the United States, to ensure that our motherland really improves its governance and its delivery of basic services to the Filipino people. Give you the question is, how do we, is it a really prosecution of the guilty? Is that one tool to achieve certain progress?
It often is counterproductive.
Counterproductive, right?
Often,
right. And how do we then, like we had a debate, that we focus not on conviction, but on the Freedom of Information Act, which is a constant, long debate, that it's more important for the Aquino government to support transparency down to the computerization of its own internal.
As you may know, we have a center at the Asian Institute of Management program on governance working closely with us here. Michael's book, which I mentioned, you can see on our website, hillsgovernance.org, and the strategy for reform, which is underway in the Philippines. The other thing you can do is send some money to AIM.
On that last point of how do we get those community-based organizations that were mentioned to be really on the ball at the local level? Because I know the AID has already increased its good governance funding to the Philippines by a couple of million. What would it take for those non-governmental organizations to succeed? Do they have to practice a certain way of holding the government accountable at a local level to the national level?
I think Frederic gave you the formula. Work in the fixed rate, work on the changing things. Any other comments?
Organizations need to offer their members quite a few different things. This goes back to the other question about organizations and what they do if they have failures. If you think about a group like the AAA, AAA is a lobby group, actually, but it has millions of members, including people like me, who don't even like what it lobbies for, because it offers a variety of services and such. And anti-corruption groups could do that, could offer sociability, could offer prestige, awards, that sort of thing, so that they have multiple kinds of incentives, not just the particular purpose for which they are formed.
I do invite you to look at our website at what they're doing at the center there.
But my two cents, if I may, your incredible constituency that you started off with, 10 million, right, mm-hmm. Filipinos in the diaspora. What an incredible constituency. They send back more money to the Philippines than any foreign direct investment, any tourism, right,
yes.
Comes up to. And there you have an extraordinary resource. Kofi Annan, when he was Secretary General, sent money back to his village in Ghana to build a school, and he found that most of the money was stolen. This is the Secretary General of the UN, right? But you, Filipinos in the diaspora, are sending back billions to the Philippines, which is, spent on consumer goods, on housing, on lots of things. How about if you could mobilize just a minuscule fraction of that towards what it would mean to improve public services and governance in the Philippines? That aid would match very, very happily. But to be dependent on aid would be sending the wrong signal. If it's coming from the diaspora, that can really have a catalytic effect.
And not through the UN.
And not through the UN. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I would like to. I'm Juliet Beltran. I'm an artist, musician, a pastor. But I like hearing from Mr. Frederic the idea that punishment, scandalizing by the media, by clergy, when something is found out, that's not really, it's not enough. Putting them in jail because they will just wait there and then devise another more creative way of becoming corrupt. And then we hear that controls are not enough either because we lower the trust of people, which is not really good in the long run. And then you mentioned that resolution is the answer. So my question here is, how do you refine resolution? That's the answer. Because maybe just resolution, we don't really know if that's already really excellent. Maybe it's just average, it's not enough. So I think our problem when we latch on resolution as a better approach, we now have something to do that's very important. We have to refine it, we have to you know, find out various methods of how resolution can be delivered.
Why don't you hold your answers for that? Let's get a couple more questions, please.
John Rosenberg, I'm an Afghanistan specialist. I've been an Afghanistan specialist off and on for 25 years. In my two most recent jobs, most recently I was on a PRT, and it was very obvious that the governor, towards the end, that the governor was corrupt, and yet because he was pro-US, we promoted him a great deal. In my job before that, I was at the Ministry of Labor, and a friend approached me who had a construction company who I had known for many, many years, his son, and he said to me that he wanted me to be a business partner instead of the guy from the Army Corps of Engineers who was getting a 50% kickback because he wanted to give the kickback to a family friend rather than to a stranger. I mean, my question is, how is that often in Afghanistan I found that we were the spoilers, and so how do you stop that from happening?
A couple more questions? Do you have any?
Me or?
That's fine. Could you stand up?
Yeah, sorry. Sarah Chase, Carnegie Endowment, also an Afghanistan background, and it's a sort of mixture of a comment and a question, but that ties into something Miguel said, and something that Frederica said in the beginning. Again, you're largely talking micro, which is great, and it's a sort of maybe all of the above is the answer. I guess the issue that I think we've been dancing around but haven't quite addressed head on has to do with power. So where corruption happens to be an element of a society, maybe you can chip away at it in this bottom-up fashion. But I guess the question is where corruption is the objective of the government in power, which it is in a number of these countries. I think one of the big reasons for failure of typical anti-corruption policies has to do with the fact that if they were to succeed, they would in effect unseat the current power. So that's where you get to kind of, what did you call it, deconcentration? Whatever you were saying, And the same thing applies then to us. So yes, Nancy, lots of money has been spent on things, but, and I've forgotten your name, I'm sorry.
We know each other, John
Rutherford. Right. But I'm looking at you from behind.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the rubber has hit the road on a national security question that matters in the United States, Afghanistan being an obvious one, anti-corruption imperatives get trumped. So we can spend money, but we tend to spend money in sort of marginal ways. And when it gets to be the National Security Council talking about it, it doesn't fly at all. So I guess that's just
Let me refer you to Michael's book, Syndromes of Corruption.
Yeah, I know.
And we'll answer questions. Let me take two more questions and way in the back there.
Yeah, I'm Ron Fernandez. I'm with Hispanic Community for Policy. And it relates, this question, my question relates, I guess the last couple of questions. And that is the macro side. And I'll just give the two examples of that. I'll just cite Chile and Dominican Republic, both at the very top level of power and authority, dismantle portion of their corruption by doing so. And so
By
handling it at the top macro level, at the very, very highest level. And then it had to be political will to do it. And there had to be a desire in the country for that to happen. So that had to exist. It did in both cases. And in both cases, they were dictators, Pinochet and Balaguer, Joaquin Balaguer in the Dominican Republic. And they were both trumped because they were looking at really some serious hard time and some serious prosecution. And they both yielded power structurally and systematically so that the countries, for example, Pinochet and Balaguer, where the countries going forward were power was more diffuse. Within the government, the institutions of government were more clear and defined, and they were there were checks and balances. And there, in both cases, the country's amount of corruption decreased dramatically. Again, diffusion of political power, not other types of power, but political power and share really helps. So my question is, have we given up on that as part of the corruption, anti-corruption? And the plan and attack and strategic.
Thank you. 1 30-second comment. Way over there.
Well, thank you. I'm Leon Weinshaw, former State Department and now the University of Wisconsin. I'd like to ask you to address the situation where you have a developing country, high unemployment. As a result, the government overstaffs the bureaucracy. This is not an unusual situation. As a result, things take a long time to get done, not because it's set up to be corrupt, but the bureaucracy essentially is set up as an employment agency. So you have a lot of people working in the government. They all have to be given a stamp to push, a signature to do, something else to do, and the only way for business or someone else to get things done in a reasonable amount of time is to pay off somebody. If the system is not set up to be a corrupt mechanism, it's set up to keep the civil service as a high employment agency, how will you be able to cut through that? The government can't fire so many people.
If you all are willing to let us go run 3 minutes over time, we'll have 3 minutes for each person to answer. Frederick, you're first.
So that goes back to one of the functions of corruption is as an employment agency. Another one in Russia is to allow themselves, for example, to tax people less. The taxation rate in Russia is very low. And at the same time, people know they have to pay for various things, but they accept it, you know, ambivalently, because the total rate is still lower than most countries' taxation rates. But again, you know, is it possible to hold the state accountable and work collaboratively to reduce some of that? Or you could do the Kuwaiti way, which was that people simply read the paper. They come into the offices every day and they simply do other things, right? And they get paid.
Like more?
Yeah. Leadership at the top. No, it's not that one has given up on that. That's the most effective form of reform, is to have an honest, competent, enlightened leader at the top who's also effective. It trumps all other methods. And I can't comment on the specifics of Chile and the Dominican Republic, whether what you describe is right or not, but you could point to Georgia during the last years, or Rwanda currently. But those are the very rare cases, very, very rare. So waiting for that white knight to appear is not a recipe for change, and is not one that simply works. You know, except for the ones who are educated and trained by Michael, like the future prime minister of India. But we still have to wait a little.
That's right.
Because the average age of prime ministers in India is around 70,
yeah.
I expect. Yeah. Now, yes, the changes I'm describing are at the micro level. It's true. Although the scale, so what we're talking about here is in an experimental phase of our work, we can demonstrate that we have improved services for over 3 million people. Now we're able to speed that process up quite a bit. So we just with a grant of $750,000 from Google, we'll be able to show, and using technology that Google is helping us develop, how we'll be improving services for 500,000 people in 18 months, just with that one grant, right? So the scale is not that small, ultimately, right? We're not talking just one water pump at a time. We're talking quite a large scale. It's true, however, that it's not dealing with things simply at the national level, and most of those I've been frustrated by. I haven't seen so many of those changes. They're rare exceptions, but they're far too rare still. So I think it's better to give it some time and to build up that constituency and experience from below, on the whole. But of course, yes, there are political considerations that will always come in and that will trump it. And you ask an absolutely astute political point, and it happens time and again, right? And if it's not aid, it's DFID. If it's not DFID, it's the World Bank that has a political agenda in one country after the other, where all of a sudden the envelope is not pushed all that hard. Again, a reason why the constituency also needs to be local, and why one of the biggest innovations that we need to have going forward is an alternative form of financing. It can't be dependent on the same donors. So if there is a way of leading the way with the Filipino diaspora, that can be absolutely transformative. And there are those diasporas for so many other countries as well. I think that's potentially one of the most powerful groups. The other one is our companies. Companies that are invested in the long term. Companies that are, for example, in agriculture. It takes a long time for that to mature. Companies in mining and extractives. Companies involved in building major infrastructure, right? Really projects that take a long time to mature, tourism, hotels, right? Those are the ones we need to be talking to. And yeah, we'd love to see the transformation happening from the Filipino diaspora.
Michael.
Very briefly, not everybody will accept this, but I think there are many cases in which there's some fundamental work to be done before we start attacking corruption. I mean, you know, people ask, how do we attack corruption in Egypt? Before we do that, we have to open up a safe political space for people who are opposed to corruption, and we need to bring more voices into the political arena, and then things might be able to happen. Many times the best approach to dealing with corruption is going to be indirect, you know, and starting with something like the trash that's not getting picked up, rather than a national sort of morality campaign. When we mount that indirect approach, we need to be aware that both a long-term and sustained effort is necessary, but it can be punctuated by periods of very rapid change as expectations begin to flip. And we need to be in a position to take advantage of those periods of very rapid change. Rather than just simply piling up reforms and hoping that synergy is going to happen. With respect to the White Knight strategy, a couple of problems with that. One, I don't think it's really sustainable. What happens when the White Knight passes from the scene? I mean, there's the famous story of Ron McLean in La Paz, who did tremendous good. Mm-hmm. His term ended. La Paz is back in the dumper in terms of corruption. Secondly, the White Knight model is very much open to abuse. I mean, for every Lee Kuan Yew, there are a dozen Sonny Abachas, frankly, who take over on a pretext of fighting corruption. Things get worse. And finally, one thing I want to point to is how Frederick's plan creates positive incentives all around, positive incentives for people to get active because their situation will improve, incentives for leaders and officials to do things that they can take credit for. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For me, the best source of political will, if that term has any meaning, is the opportunity to take credit for success.
That's a good definition.
I think a lot of it's been covered. I think the point you raised, though, about competing national security objectives is a very important one that we haven't wrestled to the ground, where every government has. I mean, the U.S. has been particularly leaning forward in terms of anti-corruption in many, many different ways. I don't think we would have had the progress to date we've had without U.S. leadership. Having said that, you're right. I mean, they support a number of governments have historically over the years, where we've had to overlook, you know, the bad in order for competing objectives. I don't think we have an answer to that. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't pick up on something that Ron said, though, that's been just bothering me like crazy, and that is just, I don't just want us to walk out of the room thinking that prosecution and enforcement of laws is irrelevant. I think about, you know, foreign bribery and the prosecution of the Siemens case, which it does a lot to change the culture. Culture doesn't change necessarily because people just see the light. Sometimes they need a whopping penalty and jail time to see it, and it sends a message to a whole lot of other people. So I think what I do like, particularly about what you said, is specifics matter a lot. And all of these things can work depending on the specific circumstances, so we shouldn't throw any of these tools out.
Yeah. Just to respond quickly. Well, as I said, prosecution is important to vindicate the rule of law. So it's not that I'm throwing it out. I was asking. What I was suggesting is sometimes it doesn't work to solve the problem. Right. It does a lot more with corporations than with people. I mean, if you took a look at New Jersey and looked at all the public officials that have been indicted and convicted over time, and the next group that comes in is just as corrupt as the former, you could see that it just doesn't work all that well. People aren't deterred. Companies are, in a way in which individuals tend not to be. But on the other thing, I think, you know, picking up on what you said about the competing objectives, that just happens all the time. I mean, I know that I could, put me in charge of something, I could eliminate all waste, abuse, and fraud within a company or an institution. The problem is it wouldn't deliver any goods or services. And so we're constantly making adjustments to see, you know, how much corruption is acceptable, how much fraud is acceptable or waste, because you can't run people like robots all the time. And with competing objectives, I mean, privacy is a competing objective. We can eliminate most crime by having a camera on every home and have it feed in. We don't want to do that because of privacy concerns. We could take all illegal guns off the market just by searching everybody's home. We don't want to do that. So we do sort of make these accommodations, and it's really a public policy question of what kind of accommodation you want to make. And I guess in the case of Afghanistan or warlords or, you know, government officials that are pro-US, the decision by the United States was to allow a certain amount of corruption, generally within limits, in order to get this short-term thing. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. All I'm saying is it's a decision that's made.
In a country like Philippines, Indonesia, Mexico, you have widespread corruption, petty corruption. When a new government comes in with a reform broom, the inclination is to sue everybody. But the fact is that a whole lot of people, bribe people, aren't all that bad. And if you have the notion you're going to sue everybody, all of a sudden you have a wall of resistance. Instead of a wall that says, we didn't like what was going through, be supportive of it. So yeah, some token, get some one or two big people, then forget about it. Let's fix the place. Thank you all for coming. We thank our panel.